find people that are a couple of steps ahead of you and follow their path. Don't be afraid to reach out to them and say, you know, hey, what did you do to get where you are, right? I'm just starting. What advice do you have for me?
Welcome back to Insights by Design, episode 9 with Andy Kriebel. We're excited to have Andy here. He's a data visualization expert. He's a trainer. He's one of Data IQ's top 100 most influential people in data. He's prolific on LinkedIn, YouTube. He has a couple of websites, and we're thrilled to have him here and to learn from him. Andy, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
We are so excited to have you. And I know I just gave a brief overview, kind of the highlights, but for those who aren't familiar with you, would you mind just giving a brief introduction?
So I'm Andy, as you mentioned. I live in the UK, even though I'm American, grew up in Philadelphia, moved to the UK, gosh, almost 9 years ago now to help start the data school. Before that, I worked at Facebook and ran the Tableau practice and data visualization there. And I kind of traveled the world doing training for them. And that's sort of when I fell in love with training people. And that's how we ended up getting involved with, or how I ended up helping start the data school about 9 years ago. Yep. And since then, I was with the data school for about 8.5 years and then had a baby and had some paid paternity leave and decided, you know what, I kind of like this. I'm going to spend as much time as I can with my family. So I decided to quit my job and start my own business. And it's terrifying.
I'm sure. You know, congratulations on a new child. That's an exciting, terrifying, as you noted, part of your life and incredibly fulfilling. So having a child and starting a new business at the same time, I'm sure you're on a roller coaster.
It's it's been really hard to manage all the things I need to do to sort of run the business. And what gets a bit frustrating is the training is what I love. So when I get into those training sessions that I do for people, it's like I get in my zone and I'm totally jazzed afterwards and everything. But my partner, Eva, she just started a new business as well. So both of us are starting a new business at the same time. So, but it's nice to have somebody going through the same thing as well, though, because then we can bounce ideas off each other. We understand the pains the other person is going through. And it's, for me, you know, while it's incredibly difficult, it's also great because I'm learning so much, so many things I've never done before. So I see it as another great way to just develop myself.
So I have a question, Andy. We talk to a lot of entrepreneurs, and terror in starting a new business is a very real thing. Could you talk to us a little bit about how you worked through the terror? How did you find the courage to keep going?
Well, it hasn't been going that long, so I'm still terrified. Okay. And I probably always will be terrified because you never know when, you know, let's say I got banned on LinkedIn for some reason, then what the heck do I do, right? Because that's where my audience is. I guess I could turn back to Twitter, but I hate Twitter. It's really hard. I'm part of a couple of coaching groups, so I have support through those. I've got other people I can turn to as well. So I've got a bit of a support network around me, which has really, really helped.
I love that. And it seems like you've jumped to a new S curve, and it feels like you've done that a couple of times. What was your motivation for moving from Facebook into the data school, which seems to be a big part of your career?
Well, the motivation was to live abroad, actually. My ex and I went to the Tableau conference in 2014 in London. I was invited to speak there along with the Tableau partner. And she came with me. The kids all stayed at home. I have four other kids as well. And we decided on the way back that we wanted to move to London. It was just, you know, we always wanted to have an international experience for our kids. We had talked about moving to Vietnam at one point. That fell through. So we've kind of had this adventurous spirit about us. And so we decided to make the plunge. I called I messaged one of the people I know at the information lab asking if they knew somebody that was hiring. And they were like, well, why don't you come work for us? We've got this idea. It sounds like you'd be a perfect fit for it. And then that's kind of how the data school got started. So it was great because when the data school got started, there was a very clear division of responsibilities. So Tom Brown, the founder of the Information Lab, he basically said, anything teaching related is yours. Anything else is mine. So it was a very, he didn't step on my toes. I didn't step on his toes. So it made it very easy to get up and running really quickly. And it was clear who was responsible for what. And I think that was a lot of the success at the very beginning.
And for those who aren't familiar, what is the Data School?
It's a training program where people, we hire people in cohorts. So I don't know how, do you still say we or how do you, anyway, when I was there, we would hire 8 people every 2 months. Well, when we first started, it was every 4 months. But as demand grew, we added more cohorts. And they go through a 4-month training program where they learn everything about Tableau, Alteryx, being a consultant, working on projects. And then they go do 2 years of consulting. And then after that, some of them stay with the company and some fly the coop and go out on their own, or they go work for, you know, go work for another company.
It's an incredible program.
So we started in London in 2015, and then in Australia in, I think it was 2017 is when Australia started. Might be 2018. So they started in Sydney, and now they're in Melbourne and Brisbane as well. And then there's a data school in Germany, and then another one in New York that started in 2022. So so it's been it's really expanded, and it kind of got to the point where I felt like I'd sort of done everything that I could do with them, and also coinciding with having a child and realizing that, you know, maybe I could do this, and I wanted to take the chance, and so things lined up pretty well. My boss was fantastic about it. He apparently explained it to one of my friends that, like a video game where I beat the last boss and I needed a new game. So I thought that was a really good analogy for it. And he's been super supportive even, you know, since I've left.
So what advantages are there to starting a business in London as opposed to, say, Silicon Valley? I thought the order of your rollout was really interesting. I think you said London, then Australia, and then Germany, and then New York?
Yeah. Well, the information lab is located in London, so that's why. They didn't have a presence in the U.S. until the data school started in the U.S.
Gotcha.
And Michael and I are both teachers. Michael's a professor at ASU. I teach graduate data programs at a few different universities. And over time, we've honed our teaching technique and how we interact with students, and we've learned what works well, what doesn't. What are some of the key findings that you found in your teaching technique as you've educated probably hundreds, if not thousands, of students?
Well, that's a good question. It's definitely changed since COVID, since so much more is online now. And I think people are actually pretty used to that now. At first, it was quite difficult to make that transition from in person. I think it's all about building the relationships with the people that you're teaching. You need to build trust with them. They need to trust you. You know, there's that's a big part of it is the interpersonal side of it. The teaching is kind of the easy part, I think. And my teaching method is typically, you know, kind of 3 parts. I'll explain the concept to you. We'll do, it tends to be 4 parts, actually. I'll explain the concept. I'll kind of demonstrate what it is. We do some exercises together, and then they do some exercises on their own. So it's that continual reinforcement of what you're learning. That's worked it really, really well.
How do you build trust with your students? As you noted, the interpersonal side can really either supercharge or hinder the learning based on your relationship with the students. What are your techniques for building trust?
A lot of it's just being there for them when they need help. Them feeling confident enough that they can ask you a question, that you got to make sure you don't come across as you're too good for them, because they can be very intimidated when they come in. And, you know, for any of the 3 of us, we have so much experience. They can be very intimidating for people to ask us questions, or they think you're too busy or those sorts of things. And I always would tell them, you know, my job is to make you really good, and anything else I do is secondary. You're the first priority. So if you're not asking me questions, I'm going to assume that you're learning just fine and you don't need any help. But if it comes to where I see you starting to struggle, we're going to chat about that. It's not going to be where I'm angry at them or you know, giving them a tongue lashing or anything like that. It's like, hey, I see you struggling with this. How can I help you? So I'll reach out to them. But then also that I want to try to encourage them, hey, you've got all these resources around you. Take advantage of that. We're all here to help you. The whole company is built around trying to help people succeed. So take advantage of that.
And now that you're doing workshops and more individualized sessions, sometimes workshops are, you know, one day, maybe 2 days. And so you have to turbocharge that trust and get it almost immediately. Mm-hmm. What differences have you found between working with a cohort over time and building that trust versus doing like a fast workshop and you need to build that credibility and rapport very fast?
Yeah, my workshops are not 2 days, they're 2 hours. So I build the trust just by giving everything away. You know, people don't really need to attend my workshops in order to learn everything I'm going to teach them. But if they want to learn, you know, if they want to learn the techniques I use, then they're going to need to attend the class, right? I give them all the content for free. But I don't really believe in those kind of workshops. I don't think they're useful to any of the students. When I started my new company, Next Level Tableau, the training program I'm running, when I talk to companies about doing training for them, one of the struggles that they have is they might bring in an external teacher or Tableau or somebody, and they run a 2 to 3 day workshop, and everybody forgets everything after the first half of the day, So why do it that way? So what I'm doing with companies now is I'm spreading that out over, let's say it's a 2 day class, right? A 16 hour class. I spread that out over 8 weeks, and you do 2 1-hour sessions per week, plus additional exercises like homework, more or less. And it helps with buy-in with managers as well, because it's very hard for managers to commit to giving somebody up for 2 or 3 days, but giving them up for 2 1-hour sessions a week is much easier, because it's just like going to 2 meetings, or just cut 2 meetings out of their schedule. I'm sure you can do that anyway. Most people have 2 meetings they can cut out every week. And that's been very, very well received. Companies like that idea of a slower learning curve. It keeps people engaged for longer. They'll retain the information because they have additional exercises. So that's how I'm trying to tackle that problem.
Can you tell us more about how you measure the impact of your courses and your workshops? One of the downsides to a lot of trainings is that there's a lot of lore, there's a lot of philosophy, but actually showing impact on students, their skills, their careers can be much more challenging. How do you do it with your businesses?
It's very difficult, especially as a trainer. It's borderline impossible to measure your impact, because you don't know was it what you taught them that helped them do this, or was it something they figured out on their own and you just happened to be there at the same time, right? So it's very difficult. I gauge a lot of my success on the feedback I get. So if I'm getting positive feedback from people and they're saying, hey, you know, what you taught me helped me develop this project that ended up getting me a promotion or something like that, right? You've got you're in that somewhere. You're not necessarily the direct cause of that, but you're definitely a contributor to that success. But it's, like you said, it's very difficult. It's very difficult to measure. And I don't think anybody's actually figured that out yet.
$1 million idea for anyone who wants to run with it.
Michael and I do focus on that at ASU. I'm the senior director of data analytics, and one of my main charges is to gauge student success. So defining it, understanding impact, as you noted, it is a difficult question because it goes beyond grades. It goes beyond student satisfaction scores. Mm-hmm. Like Michael has, surprisingly, a very good Rate My Professor score.
I didn't even know I was on Rate My Professors.
You are. And you have a very good score. But it's really like a biased, like we had a good experience or we didn't, but it's like, how do you measure outcome?
Yeah. I think that's where, you know, I think one of the ways you could measure that is, you know, what do people do in their careers? Mm-hmm. Like, did they get there faster because of what they did? So if I think about people that have gone through the data school, I'm probably going to overestimate this, 20 to 25% of the Tableau visionaries have gone through the data school. And there's, you know, I don't know, 10 or 15 Alteryx, maybe not quite that many, maybe 10 Alteryx aces that have gone through the data school. So we've got that proven track record, or I have that proven track record on the Tableau side of that, of, you know, proof that, you know, what I teach works, right? These people wouldn't get to that without that training. It also is a lot of them working on their own and, you know, working really hard outside of the training as well. So they have to have that drive to become really good as well. Some people just want to go through the training and do their job and that's it. And there's nothing wrong with that. But some people really take it and take off.
And you've noted that you are a tableau visionary and you've trained many tableau visionaries. What is a tableau visionary?
That's a good question. So it started off as a Zen Master program and they got renamed a couple of years ago for political reasons. What it is it has to be somebody that is that shares in the community, technical expert. What are the other pillars? There's three or four pillars. I'm totally blanking on what those are at the moment, but it has nothing really to do with certain certifications, like let's say a Microsoft MVP you can get by taking a test. This isn't a test. You have to do all this stuff selflessly. You have to earn it. If somebody's goal is to become a visionary, I think they're doing it for the wrong reasons. You should get it by what you do, not by, you know, it's kind of flipping it the other way around. So when I nominate people to be visionaries, it's people I see that are just doing stuff for people selflessly. They're giving a lot. They're helping people. They're obviously technical experts. I struggle when I see people set that as their goal. I'm like, well, why is that your goal? You know, your goal shouldn't be that. Your goal should be to be really good and to help people and help people solve problems. And then if you happen to get it, fantastic.
I love that. And it reminds me, Michael and I focus on design elements for AI, ML, and analytics apps driving business results. And you find, at least I find sometimes on Tableau Public or in some of these really beautiful visualizations that clearly won't drive business outcomes.
Yeah.
What's your philosophy or process for helping your students drive business outcomes through data visualization?
Yeah. I think it's wonderful what people can, what they can create with Tableau. I think it's fascinating. That's not my style. I don't want to create things like that. Could I learn to do it? Probably, but I'd rather go learn, you know, to continue to improve the simple things. And, you know, how do you continue to build a better bar chart, for example, right? One that communicates a bit better. That's something that's going to be more impactful for lots of people that I reach than me building something fancy that nobody's going to learn from. But I didn't answer your question.
No, that's fine. So let's take your bar chart as an example. So how would you know if your bar chart is communicating better than a previous bar chart that you may have made?
I would do it through feedback with stakeholders. I think that's something people miss a lot is they might create something that meets the brief, for example, and they, you know, it's so they and then they chalk it up and move on to the next project, but they miss that feedback loop to continue to improve it. So how are people using it? What are they clicking on? Is it helping them answer the questions that they started the project? You know, why did the project start in the first place? And is it answering those questions? But you only get that by asking people. So if you're missing that feedback loop, then you can't continue to evolve that dashboard because the questions you're answering today aren't going to be the questions that need to be answered next time or a month from now or a year from now. So you have to continue to ask for feedback on, you know, does it help you answer those questions that you need answered? Is it simple enough? Can you make decisions from it? Does it have the right metrics? All those sorts of little things that you have to continue to refine to move along with the business.
As a UX professional, this is music to my ears. If you want to know if something is working, go out and test it and talk to people.
Exactly, yeah.
And is that part of your trainings, Andy, this product management-minded feedback loop?
Yeah, I mean, I give feedback when they ask for it. Again, it's a trust thing. You know, they can come ask me for help or for feedback. They don't have to. So in my training program, we have something called office hours where they can bring questions or problems that they want solved. Or we talk about like one of the sessions we wanted a bit more information about some of the products that Tableau sells and why would people buy them and how do you position Tableau versus Power BI. So I went and got a salesperson from Tableau that I know to join the call. Then we had a careers chat. So it goes beyond, you know, just the kind of technical help that you can give people. Yes, I can help them and give them that feedback along the way. And I want them to learn how to give and receive feedback. So we've developed a bit of a buddy system so you can pair up with somebody and mentor, or, you know, I'm kind of letting them evolve it themselves, through the community. And then, when they take this stuff into work, you know, we will talk about, you know, well, what are the successes you're having? What are the struggles you're having? What can you do different next time?
Can you tell us more about what makes good feedback? There have been lots of studies on how people come to master particular skills, whether it's chess or golf or French cuisine. And one of the keys, especially for adult learners, tends to be feedback from people who generally know what they're talking about, although sometimes we can have cheer up as well. Talk to us more about the feedback practices that you've come to espouse and the ones that you find particularly effective for you and for your students.
Yeah. Unfortunately, most feedback people get is negative. They very rarely get positive feedback. And that's, I actually wrote about that today on LinkedIn, that I think it's a real problem, I think. And it's discouraging for people if all the feedback they get is negative. So for example, you know, I created a dashboard one time where, let's say a typical business dashboard, they want to know what's wrong so they can take action on it. So what if you created a dashboard that just always showed everything that's good, right? So then how does that change the mindset of the people that are receiving that dashboard? Because all they're seeing is good news. They're not being inundated with bad news. Of course, they can still, you know, you can make the inference in your head that if it's not good, it's bad. But it's just that kind of psychological difference you can do. But as far as like giving feedback, it's a bit of an art. I think you need to, your feedback has to be specific. If you just say, oh, your dashboard looks nice. Well, come on, you can do better than that. Like, what is nice about it? You know, it's what works, what doesn't, why does it not work? You know, why does what does work specifically? And it has to be timely. So, for example, if somebody presents a dashboard, and I need to give them feedback, I make notes on specifically, you know, what they could have done better and what they specifically did really well, and then I give them that feedback right away, so it's fresh on their mind. They know what you're talking about, you know. And the worst is, you know, a manager that waits till the end of the review cycle to tell you how you're doing. If you ever have a surprise when you get to a performance review, then you've got a crappy manager. Nobody should ever have a surprise when it comes to a performance review. And unfortunately, that's how it goes in most places, right? Most managers are not very good managers. It has to be actionable and it has to be timely. I think those are the two most important things.
Actionable, timely. You mentioned specificity. And sometimes in education, we talk about summative feedback and formative feedback. Summative being like your manager review at the end of the quarter, and formative feedback meaning the feedback, the comments you get along the way so that you can make corrections before you roll out the final deliverable and everybody hates it. I think business managers considered both not just summative feedback, but formative feedback, they would have much better results and much happier employees.
Yeah. If you think about the dashboard development cycle as an example, you're given a brief at the beginning. Well, and so one of the problems I think people have is they just take the brief and go with it. They don't ask why. And I encourage people to only, don't let them tell you what they want. You need to get them to tell you what they need. And because it's your job as the analyst and as the designer to make it look the right way or to give them the proper data, you need to understand what questions they're trying to answer. So when you're building a dashboard, I think the first thing you should do is put a title on there that is the question you're trying to answer. And everything you put on that dashboard has to answer that question. If it doesn't, you obviously don't need it, right? You can always change the title at the end, but it helps you focus on what needs to be in that dashboard first. And then, but that's kind of the end of the line. But as you kick off their project, you understand the questions that you're trying to get answered or what they need. You need to continue to ask them for feedback along the way. If you wait till the end to get feedback on your dashboard, it's probably not going to meet their needs. But if you get that feedback along the way, you know, maybe it's if it's a you know a month long project, maybe it's you know twice a week or something like that that you get feedback from them. And it doesn't have to. It can be 10 minutes. It can be 5 minutes over a cup of coffee, whatever. It doesn't have to be anything formal. Definitely go through sketches with them, because then that kind of removes the software usability element of it, I guess. I'm not quite sure how to phrase that, but it makes it much more about the design. And also, if you use things like Balsamiq or Excalidraw, you could just move things around on the screen like sticky notes. And some people actually use sticky notes, right? Get a big piece of paper and put sticky notes on there and move them around and get with the stakeholder and put it up on the wall and let's talk about, you know, well, what makes this more usable for you here than over here? And, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I often tell students that there's a lot of power in paper, especially when you're at the early stages of a design project. So if you wanted to roll out a dashboard, for instance, if you present your stakeholders with a fully developed dashboard and say, well, what do you think about it? You might not get great feedback because they might think, wow, this guy's put a lot of work onto this dashboard and I guess we're stuck with it. But if you do something that's lower fidelity, like Balsamiq, or even just sketching things out on a piece of paper, then people can focus much more on the ideas and the purposes behind it as opposed to the bells and the whistles.
Yeah, exactly.
And I've seen a trend recently, maybe over the last year, where folks are saying self-serve analytics are dead. The dashboard is dead. What are your thoughts on that, Andy?
I disagree, of course. There's always going to be a need, right? People need that overview. They don't want to do the work themselves to if you think about an executive, it's not worth their time. Their time is too valuable to be going and doing the analysis or, you know, using, some AI or something to look at, to figure out what's wrong with the business. They need people to tell them what's going on. And that happens through dashboards, right? Or apps or, you know, something like that, that gives them an update on what's going on. So I don't think that's going anywhere.
I agree with you. I think to your points about how you teach and how you train, that product management focus hasn't been there. And we've been providing executives with dashboards where they have to drill down or they have to do exploratory analysis to answer their own question versus your approach where you start with the question and then you line up the KPIs or data that answers that question and makes it very easy and meets the need.
Yeah. There's been a big focus lately on LinkedIn I've seen as well. So I post lots of, you know, examples of dashboards and things and ask for feedback. And almost every time people are like, it needs to be able to drill down. Well, no, it doesn't. It doesn't have to be able to drill down. I think yesterday I wrote about, you know, well, a dashboard doesn't need to drill down. It's okay if it just has the metrics that are needed. And that's all you need, right? It all depends on going back to the beginning. It just depends on the question you're trying to answer. But people seem to be fixated lately on it has to be able to drill down into the details to answer the question. Well, it depends, right? But who's the audience? If it's an executive, they're not going to do that. So don't waste your time building something that does that. Don't have any filters on there. They're not going to filter. You know, they're going to want you to develop something that tells them what's going on. They don't have to go find what's going on. They want you to tell them what's going on.
And often they're just looking at their phone. Do you have a specific design principle when you're deciding what works well on a desktop versus a mobile device?
Well, in my experience, mobile is used very, very little. I do know how to design on mobile. It's quite different. You know, you have to do it through scrolling and pay attention to the types of, like filtering. You're like, do they need to tap on something to do something? Well, if they do, how do you tell them? And does it do something weird that they're not expecting? Or, you know, you should probably limit the interactivity you have on a mobile dashboard. Because it's, I think of a mobile dashboard more like a report than a dashboard. But I haven't really seen a huge adoption of mobile yet.
I've only seen it with executives where they're on their phone all the time, traveling all the time. And with that, we've used a few different keywords, you know, reports, dashboards. To you, what's the difference?
A report is something that I think is a it's something that I'm trying to figure out exactly what the distinction is, because I was going to say it's something that I think of a dashboard as something that continues to update over time, where a report is a one-time snapshot. And a report tends to be less interactive than a dashboard. I think about printing a piece of paper would be like a report, whereas interacting with it on your computer would be like a dashboard. That's kind of a, that's probably the most diverging type of example. But I think of reports as, you know, here's what's going on, here's what we need to do, and let's go do it, right? Not a dashboard, which is, you know, which can have those elements too, but a dashboard is typically, here's what's going on. You also need to go find out yourself what's going on next, right? So there's a bit more of the analytical side, I guess, to a dashboard than there is to a report.
I love that. So it's more about the utility rather than the technology, because it sounds like you could build reports within Tableau for sure. In addition, you could build dashboards.
Exactly. Yeah. Every tool supports both.
And you focused on Tableau, and I love Tableau as a product. Why did you focus on Tableau? What drew you to that specific technology?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I was given a project back in 2007. Jeez, it's been 16 years now. To basically build a dashboard. I was working at Coca-Cola at the time. We didn't really have any dashboarding software. Everything was done in Excel, but it was very clunky. It was quite hard to do. It was very hard to maintain. So I just Googled dashboard software, and Tableau was the first thing that came up. You know, the description looked like something I was looking for, and I looked at the website, downloaded the free trial, watched a couple videos, and then I had the whole project done in like 30 minutes from the Google search to the project being done. So I was like, oh, well, this is pretty fun. So I think it's the fun aspect to it is what kept me with Tableau and still does. I just there was nothing else really to explore at the time. We had like business objects, but that is so awful. And again, it's a business objects is reports. They're definitely not dashboards. And we needed something that allowed interactivity and filtering and that sort of stuff.
That's probably an underrated design principle, because when I talk to UX pros and data analysts, they often talk about efficiency, clean look, you know, productivity, but a lot of good digital products are all those things, but they're also fun. And Tableau's been remarkably successful in developing not just a really loyal group of customers, but a whole community around it. Partly,
yeah,
you said, because it's fun.
Yeah, that's their secret sauce, I think. And if they ever lose the community, that's going to really hurt the product.
I agree with you. Most companies I've worked for offer multiple dashboarding softwares, but yeah. Tableau has the Tableau Public, which is really great for new analysts to get inspiration and to get exposure. They have the really great community where things like Click, Power BI, even Looker, they don't really have a community built around it. You can't really publish a Power BI dashboard to a server for everybody to look at and give feedback on.
Right.
Tableau's nailed that. And with Tableau, they've continued to expand their features and services, one of which is they're adding AI into their program. Mm-hmm. Where do you see the future of dashboarding and data visualization with AI coming out?
Well, Tableau's coming out with Tableau Pulse. I think that's what you're referring to. It actually looks really fantastic. It's a problem Tableau's actually been trying to solve for quite a while. So built into the tool is something called Explain Data, which hardly anybody even knows about. There was also a product called Ask Data, which is where somebody could type in a natural language sentence. Nobody used it. It was something like 0.2% of users actually used that product. And Pulse is kind of the next evolution of those, which is really interesting because it feels like a giant leap forward from where they were. And there's a lot of actually excitement about this one where there wasn't before. So I think it's going to be used quite heavily. I think we're going to see, one of the things we're going to see, I think, is less dashboards, actually. We're going to see more metrics that people are going to create. And then you might have a landing page that has metrics on it instead. I guess that could be called a dashboard. I think of those as those are KPIs. It explains right there what's going on. That's going to be it's going to make the analytics easier. I'm still skeptical that, well, my worry is that people are going to just accept what it says, and assume that, that's the answer and not try to verify that, or, you don't want to take the analyst out of a data analyst.
And with your training that you're offering, what new skills do you think data analysts or data visualization specialists are going to need to have with the rollout of AI, not just within Tableau, but now we've got ChatGPT, we've got all these other integrations with AI. What new skills are data analysts going to need?
I think you're going to need to know how to ask good questions of AI. If you're not using ChatGPT as a productivity tool, you're silly. It's so helpful for, I use it a lot for building dummy data sets. So somebody might have a problem and then they're in a particular industry, let's say telecom, and you can use ChatGPT to help you build out a dummy data set with telecom data, right? As long as you know how to prompt it, everything, then you're really well on your way. There's now a capability to interpret charts and what's going on with trends. The problem with that is there's no background context for that. So you're going to need to know both how to use the AI tools and how to prompt them and how to get the answers you're looking for, but then also how to verify those that they're actually the correct answers. I really think if you're not on the ball with that already, you're probably behind.
And it sounds like, tell me if I'm wrong, it sounds like one of your main beliefs that the data analyst needs to stay in the loop is because they're going to be the key quality assurance loop for AI-driven data. So if before the dashboard goes live, there's some analyst making sure that what it's saying is correct, or however they're creating that data, the data analyst is the key QA person. Is that accurate?
Yeah. Yeah.
I've been approached by a lot of companies who are trying to sell their new software, and their main value proposition is we're removing your need to have data analysts. And, hire our AI. Yeah, exactly. Yes. I completely agree with you. What tips would you have for somebody who's interested in data analytics and data visualization, but they don't know how to get started or where to start looking? What tips would you have for a person like that?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is to just start getting involved in some kind of community. Find people that are like-minded. There's lots of user groups or Facebook groups or, Reddit, whatever, for new people. Try to find people that are a couple of steps ahead of you and follow their path. Don't be afraid to reach out to them and say, hey, what did you do to get where you are, right? I'm just starting. What advice do you have for me? So I think you need to try to find, I guess those are like mentors in the way, but I wouldn't necessarily ask somebody to be a formal mentor, right? You can find lots of mentors just by following people. So you want to look for people that are a couple of steps ahead of where you are. I would probably make sure you know SQL. I still think that's probably the number one skill people need. And then as far as the data analysis, data visualization, I would try lots of different tools. See which ones you like, see which ones resonate with you, which ones kind of work with the way your brain works. So for example, if you really love kind of data preparation combined with visualization, then maybe Power BI is the tool. You're not really as concerned with analytics, but you love data preparation and then building dashboards from that, right? Power BI is a great tool for that because it's seamlessly integrated. If you want to do a lot of visual analytics, well, Tableau is significantly better than Power BI is at that, right? So they each, but Tableau is not very good at, you know, Tableau Prep is a separate tool where Power BI is all integrated into one tool. So they have a different model of how they approach that. So you want to kind of try to find your niche, I guess. Engage with people. You know, it's very easy to be a lurker at the beginning, but don't be afraid to comment on people's posts. You'll be surprised at how much people will engage with you because they, you know, people post stuff because they want to be in a conversation. You can tell pretty quickly if somebody's posting things just for themselves.
I completely agree. And one of the great resources that you've provided, among many, is Makeover Monday. What is the premise of your book, Makeover Monday?
So the book came about, Makeover Monday started in 2016 as a project just with Andy Cotgrave and myself. So he's an evangelist at Tableau. He hadn't been using Tableau very much and he wanted to get back into it. He noticed that I was doing this thing called Makeover Monday by myself. Every Monday I just happened to do a makeover of a visualization, right? And then a friend of mine, Emily Kuhn, came up with the alliteration for it. So Andy was like, well, why don't we do this every Monday? We'll just call it Makeover Monday. And if other people join, you know, I threw together a website and if other people join, fantastic. If not, that's okay. We're going to improve our skills. So the idea is to give people, and then, you know, there ended up being like thousands of people that joined and it was just, you know, remarkable. In 2022, I think it was 2022, there were over 10,000 visualizations created as well submitted. Right. So there used to be a tracker. So I'm sure it was way more than that. But it was really cool to see the growth of it. But the idea is we wanted to give a platform for people to have clean data sets to work with on lots of different topics that don't take a lot of time to analyze and to do build visualizations from. So removing a lot of the hurdles and getting people like really good at fundamentals. It's tool agnostic, but most of it is Tableau. It's about trying to help the people that are just starting for them. I mean, that's most of the people that do Makeover Monday are have either been doing it for a very long time or they're just starting. And it's a great way for people to build a portfolio. We encourage them to publish everything. And the book came, in 2016, Andy Cotgrave and I ran the project together and then Andy didn't want to do it anymore. So I asked Eva Murray to join me. In the project. And then at the end of 2017, she was like, well, why don't we write a book about everything we learned? Because we were writing a blog post every week about lessons learned. We would highlight visualizations we liked. And basically, we were able to take that content and make a book out of it. We had to have the whole thing written in, I think, 7 weeks.
Ooh.
In order to have it ready for the Tableau conference in October. So January of 2018, we started writing the book and we had the manuscript in by like middle of February, something like that.
That's amazing.
It was great. It was a lot of long nights, weekends, it was a great experience. She's gone on to write two more books. I decided I was one and done. But it's been really useful for people, and it is seen much more now as a tool agnostic book. When you read it, it's not built for Tableau or for Power BI or Looker or anything. It's built to help you see and understand your data. Right? We want people to get better one chart at a time, and that's why I still do Makeover Monday every week. There's 400 different data sets out there for people to play with. You know, I mean, where else can you get 400 unique data sets? The topics are like so varied. One was like turkey vultures and the flight paths of turkey vultures. There's baseball and there, you know, so we try to, it's really whatever I found that was interesting and hopefully the visualization could use some improvement. The most interesting weeks were when you might use something from like 538, where the visualizations tend to always be, you know, very good, or from the Financial Times or The Economist. And because what's really neat about those is you're trying to improve it. But when you're doing that feedback, right, I always wrote about what I liked, what I didn't like, what I would do different. It gets really hard to pick those things apart. But that's where you learn about feedback, right? You learn how to give good feedback because you're writing it down every week. And people are going to read it. It's important when you do that kind of feedback that it's not about the person. It's about the work. So if somebody takes your feedback personally, then that's on you for delivering it. Not, you know, you didn't deliver it the right way. So I guess that goes back, Michael, to your question earlier about another thing with feedback is it has to be about the work and not the person. So the book came out in 2018. At the Tableau conference, there was a long line of people. You know, we signed books for hours, which was really kind of weird. Like, it's just this like super nerdy conference where, you know, there's this book there, and you know, and Eva and I were, I guess, like pseudo celebrities. I mean, that sounds a bit arrogant, but you know, a lot of people knew who we were. We used to run a pre-conference session for Makeover Monday where people could come, and you know, that most of them had never done Makeover Monday before. We had 1,000 people attend one year, and we asked people to come up and present at the end of the session. And you know, and most of the people that present aren't done. It's an okay viz, but they're so excited that they were able to build something in an hour, and then to get the chance to present it. So it takes a lot of courage to get up and stand in front of 1,000 people. You don't probably know very few of them, and present something that you know isn't finished, right? But that you're proud of yourself for creating. And so it's been great. So I stepped away at the end of last year, I didn't finish last year. I just got kind of burned out from it. I get burned out from running the project. I'm not burned out from actually doing Makeover Monday. So 3 other people have now taken it over. And I used to do a weekly live stream as well, where I would, you know, people could watch along and follow how I approach a visualization. What are the different charts that I build? I try to explain everything along the way as well, so that people can learn, you know, instead of me just sitting there quiet, I'm explaining to them why I'm doing the things I'm doing along the way. And what is this calculation going to do? And I've gotten a lot of really good feedback about those sessions. So I did one last week, kind of a surprise last minute. I just threw it up and said, well, you know, I'm going to work on this at 12 o'clock. So why don't I just live stream it and see what happens? And the Facebook live stream didn't go up for some reason. So it was just on LinkedIn, but that's okay. But I love the feedback that people have as they're jumping in. So I'm going to still do them occasionally, depending on, you know, kind of what my calendar looks like. If I know I can sit down for an hour and work on it, then I'll probably live stream it.
I love that. And I think your authenticity and building in public is probably a large reason why people feel comfortable receiving feedback from you. But as a coach and a trainer, it also sounds like you've mastered the feedback process, which is incredibly important. But another thing that you've mastered, which I sent to all my teams, are your fundamentals. You really have mastered the fundamentals of data visualization. What are some of those fundamentals that you feel like are critical to a good visualization?
It has to be obvious what you're talking about. Going back to, you know, you talk about a dashboard, for example, you know, it needs to be answering the question, what's the purpose? Everything you have, typically everything you have on a dashboard should have some kind of context. So when you create a chart, it can be a bar chart, line chart, whatever, ask yourself compared to what, and that'll really help you give that context and also probably give them where they need to take action as well. Think about, big numbers and how do those work? Don't just give a big number because, you know, it might say 250,000 in sales. I don't know if that's good or bad, right? If you're new to the company, you might think, oh, wow, 250,000, that's fantastic, but it's 10% of what you did the year before or something like that, you know? So it's all relative. So context is key. So I teach that a lot. Simple charts, probably 90% of what you do should be bars and lines. Maybe big numbers you might throw in there as well. So maybe those 3. If you master those 3 and you learn how to use maybe color to highlight things, You learn how to add context. That's going to cover almost everything you need to do. When you start getting into things like scatter plots, even, you know, they're relatively simple, but people really have trouble understanding a scatter plot. So, you know, don't put it on there. Like a heat map is another one that people really understand. They're super easy to understand. So, you know, go with the heat map. So that might be on that, on maybe the list of the top five. Even maps, you know, people are used to them, but they tend to not communicate very well just because of, you know, this different sizes of states, for example. So that's where you need to think about, well, should I use maybe a hex map instead of a, you know, instead of a regular map? Like, how important is the specific location of where the state is? Is it okay if it's shifted over a little bit, if everything gets equal attention? So you need to make those sort of decisions. And most stakeholders actually really like hex maps of the U.S. when you show them. They're different, but they're super, super easy to understand because geographically things are pretty much where they need to be. And it's something that's different for them to look at. You can add a lot of interactivity, but when you do add interactivity, keep it simple, have basic filtering, know how to limit your data. So only include the data you need, only include the fields that you need, because that'll just speed it up. It's, you know, the more data you have, the slower it's going to be. That's just how things work. I think, you know, keep it to simple charts. Learn how to add context and learn how to use color with those charts.
The football coach Vince Lombardi was famous for walking into the Packers training camp in 1961 and starting really, really, really fundamental. He started off by saying something like, "Gentlemen, this is a football. It's this many inches. It weighs this much. Gentlemen, this is a football field. It's this long." And he's talking to professional football players here. I mean, they probably are familiar with the football and the field and the rules of the game, but he believes so strongly in fundamentals that he tried to get them over and over again. And in fields like UX or data analytics, I think it's really helpful to return to those basic assumptions again and again. Gentlemen and ladies, this is a line, or this is a bar, this is a scatter or a heat map or a hex map. Here's some of the assumptions built into them, and here's some of the things that they can do. Because sometimes I think we get so used to our way of doing things that we forget some of the assumptions we are making, or sometimes we lose sight of what our stakeholders need. And there's so much power in returning to fundamentals, whether we're new in the field or whether we're experienced professionals.
Yeah. I mean, look at the main websites that create the best visualizations, 538, the New York Times, Financial Times, The Economist. They don't use complicated charts, because their stuff only is going to get at a glance, right? So if they can't catch your eyeball, then and make it easy for you to understand what they're doing, then they've lost you. Think about, you know, if you watch the news, when they pop up a chart on the news, is there anything complicated about the charts? Like, look at the elections, right? When they put charts up for the elections, there's nothing complicated. You've got big numbers. What's the difference between the two? How many do they need? You know, so they all have those contexts. You might see, you know, voter trends, but it's just a line chart. You don't see anything complicated because they need people to be able to consume and understand the information. And we grow up seeing line charts and bar charts, right? So, you know, don't overcomplicate it.
As you mentioned a few times, Andy, an important consideration is not just what the purpose of the viz is or what it's supposed to accomplish, but how much time do your readers actually have? Does this have to be understood at a glance, or do they have time to actually pore over it? And so as we're designing things, I think the time and the context of use is so important and can't be overemphasized.
Yeah. Well, and that's one of the things you should ask your stakeholders as well, is how are they going to use it? Because you might not ask them that question. You build something for a computer screen, and then they actually they're only ever going to use it on their phone. And you've just wasted who knows how much time. And it's completely different use. It's completely different design that you need to do for a mobile versus a computer.
Absolutely.
And that's one of the reasons the fundamentals are so important. And one of the main reasons that I send lots of visualizations that you've created, Andy, to my teams. I sent them your visual vocabulary where you remade the Financial Times. I sent them your KPI post that you did the other day. Incredible resources.
Andy, it's been such a pleasure speaking with you. I hope we can do this again. I will link all of your resources down below. And so excited to see what you do with Next Level Tableau.
Thank you. I appreciate your time, and thanks for having me on. I've enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you, Andy.
Thank you. And then the